loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. My co-host, John Kiriakou, is traveling this week. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, Cuba has completed its election process, and Cuba has a new head of state. We'll talk about Cuba, the Cuban elections, and what's next for U.S.-Cuban relations. And today we continue our weekly series every Thursday called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the police, the prosecutors, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country, including the prison killings in South Carolina and the planned execution today of an 83-year-old man in Alabama.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, cancer is not only traumatic and deadly, but it can be incredibly expensive to treat. One organization, Value in Cancer Care Consortium, has been working on cutting those costs to make cancer treatment more readily available. And for one treatment, the researchers were able to confirm that just one-third of a drug for blood cancer was just as effective as the previously recommended dose. This would, of course, cut the treatment costs by a third, until Janssen and Pharmacyclics tripled their prices in response. Next, the Department of Health and Human Services is reportedly planning to issue regulations that will further restrict undocumented people's ability to access healthcare. We'll take an in-depth look today and tomorrow at this latest attack on immigrants and the barriers to healthcare access that already existed. Then, yesterday evening, Charles County, Maryland residents rallied at the town council building to protest fracking and a potential new fracked gas compressor station. Fracking is a problem nationwide that is hazardous to the environment and to the people living nearby. And then, Puerto Rico suffered a huge blackout yesterday, leaving the entire island without power, which has still not yet been fully restored. Months after Puerto Rico was hit with a devastating hurricane, critical infrastructure is still yet to be repaired. And finally, the Syrian army has given ISIS a 48-hour deadline to vacate areas south of the capital Damascus, primarily the Palestinian refugee camp of Yarmouk, which has suffered under ISIS's brutal rule since the spring of 2015. Meanwhile, controversy continues to swirl over the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma. And in other headlines, the first Democratic senator, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, has said she will support CIA Director Mike Pompeo's nomination as Secretary of State, making his nomination much more likely to succeed. Republicans have a 51-49 majority in the Senate, and Republican Senator Rand Paul has announced that he will vote against Pompeo. South Korean President Moon Jae-in said today that North Korea has committed to complete denuclearization even without the United States committing to remove their huge troop presence in South Korea. Moon said, quote, "I don't think denuclearization has different meanings for South and North Korea. All they are talking about is the end of hostile policies against North Korea, followed by a guarantee of security." Deontay Yarber was 26 and unarmed when he was shot down in a Walmart parking lot on April 40th. Police shot 30 bullets at the black father of three while he was in a car with four passengers about 2 hours south of Los Angeles. Authorities and Yarber's lawyer announced this killing just this week. Two additional passengers were wounded, including one who is still hospitalized. The Inspector General at the Department of Justice has sent its findings on the conduct of former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe to the U.S. Attorney for Washington's office, which will consider pressing criminal charges. While the Inspector General's inquiry was not a criminal probe, there is speculation that McCabe's, quote, lack of candor will result in charges in a criminal court. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion on the new Cuban president.
Loud and clear.
But first, we turn to the election in Cuba of a new leader of the Cuban government. Miguel Díaz-Canel has been elected by the National Assembly to be the new president of Cuba. As the country embarks on a historic leadership transition as Raúl Castro steps down, what does the future hold for Cuba and its socialist system? We're joined in studio by Arnold August. He is a lecturer, journalist, and the author of the book Cuba and the U.S. in the Age of Trump. And we're joined from San Francisco, California, by Gloria Lariva. She is the director of the Cuba and Venezuela Solidarity Committee. She's also running for governor of California on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. Gloria and Arnold, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
It's a pleasure to be here, and best of luck to you, Gloria. I hope you win that election.
Well, with the level of corporate backing that Gloria and the Peace and Freedom Party has, I think it's almost guaranteed that
yes.
Gloria will, in fact, be the next governor of California.
Right.
Gloria, or Arnold, let's start with you. You're here in studio. It is a historic day. Of course, the Cuban Revolution happened, 1959, January 1st. The leader of that historic revolution was the historic figure, Fidel Castro, when he had to retire because of health. Raul Castro was nominated and became the new head of state. Now there will be a head of state whose last name is not Castro.
His last name is not Castro. And also, it's the first time that you have someone leading the country who did not participate in the 1950 revolution. In fact, he was born 1 year after the revolution in 1959. He is also not from the military ranks, so it's an entirely different situation. He'll become, I think tomorrow he'll be 58 years old, which is pretty young in terms of the Cuban political system.
Gloria, I saw you in Cuba at the time of Fidel's death, loud and clear. We went there and we covered Cuba. We talked to people about what it meant for Fidel. He was no longer the head of state when he died, but he was, of course, in many ways, the living legacy of the revolution or the personification of it. That was a very sad moment for the Cuban people, not a surprise, in fact, because Fidel had been sick for some time. That allowed Cuba to have an orderly transition. Does this appear to you to be an orderly transition? And if so, does it signify or might it signify anything new inside of Cuba's political system?
Oh, yes, it's a very orderly transition. In fact, the theme of this time in this session of the National Assembly, which continues today, is continuity of the revolution. And I think that's definitely the sense in the population. There have been, the process began almost 2 years ago, but in the last month there have been on television daily explanations of who all the candidates were to the National Assembly, interviews with them, and so people do get to know who they are. It encompasses all of society, the different mass organizations and experiences of the Cuban population. So it is what people are accustomed to from the previous elections. The only difference is a new president.
Okay, we've seen in different countries, when Lenin died in the Soviet Union, it was a big leadership shakeup, and there was a faction fight. There was a right, a left, a center, however you characterize it. Different factions formed within the Bolshevik Party, and they sort of fought it out till the end. Following Mao Zedong's death, the Maoist wing of the party, or a great number of them, were actually immediately imprisoned, and there was a transformation there. It's not unusual to have a big faction fight at a moment of transition. This, however, Arnold, there's been a lot of years to prepare for this. The Cuban Communist Party, a ruling party, has carefully prepared and deliberated on this. Why did they choose this particular individual through the process of the National Assembly elections and the other vetting processes?
Well, firstly, I would like to say that the choice, in my view, is very good. I've only met him for a few seconds last fall. I was very impressed with that very short meeting I had with him of a few minutes, but I've also been watching all of his speeches that he's been making in the last few years. But I think the most important thing is that he has the following experience. He was a leader of the youth wing of the Communist Party in his province of Villa Clara. He later became the first secretary of the province of Villa Clara. And then because of his outstanding work there, he was sent to Holguín to be the first secretary of the province of Holguín. But in my view, one of the most important features of his development over the last few years is when he was named to be head of the Ministry of Higher Education, or the ministry responsible for all of the universities throughout Cuba. I think that had a major impact on Cuban society. I was in Cuba last March, invited by the Ministry of Higher Education to give a talk there, and I had an opportunity during 4 days, period of 4 days, to interact with all of the leadership the Ministry of Higher Education. And even though Miguel Díaz-Canel was not there, I would say that he left his impact on that ministry. That ministry is a hotbed of revolution. I think that with the leadership coming into the hands of Miguel Díaz-Canel, the latent increasing desire on the part, especially of the Cuban youth, to deepen the revolution, to make sure that the United States does not make any inroads into Cuba. This will be even further strengthened with Miguel Díaz-Canel as president of Cuba.
In the years leading up to the overthrow of the Soviet Union and in the years immediately following that, most of the countries in the world that define themselves as socialist either collapsed, either fell themselves, or they radically restructured their economy so that the private sector and private ownership played a much more substantial role, or perhaps even the dominant role in the economies. Cuba took a different path. I mean, Cuba, the slogan in the 1990s was socialism or death. However, that doesn't mean that Cuba hasn't made any modifications to its socialist system, to its planned economic system. And there have been some pretty substantial ones in the past several years, especially following the Great Recession in 2008. Gloria, tell us a little bit about those reforms and what do you think that Miguel Díaz-Canel's presidency means for them?
Well, they were definitely limited from the time of the mid-1990s of what they call the special period to help people find other means of employment after the state could no longer employ everybody, but it was increased, intensified, starting in 2008 under President Raul Castro at the time. But it encompassed different factors in the economic changes, and that was not so much changes as definitely an increase in the number of self-employment. Now there's over 600,000 people who are involved in self-employment, ranging from plumber, construction, to having restaurants. But it is not, and they state clearly, it is not over the means of production, that is the means of the factories, the land. The land is distributed to the people in the form of cooperatives, collectives. There are some private farms, very few, but they've always existed since the time of the revolutionary triumph. But the land is still state-owned. The means of production of the factories, the industry is still state-owned. It's still on a socialist basis. But the reason for the changes is so that the state does not have the burden of having full state employment. It was becoming very, very problematic for the economy to continue to provide free health care, free education, all the social needs of the population, which is still quite costly to the economy, and to make the country far more self-sufficient. That's why starting in 2008, they distributed 2 million more acres of land so that the country could rely less and less on imports, because being an island, being blockaded by the U.S., and being subject to the ups and downs of, for example, the price of commodities, you know, in 2008, the nickel, which is it was the number two source of income, fell from $50,000 a ton on the world market to $9,000. So it became a huge loss for them, billions of dollars. So the changes are intended to keep the economy going and, in fact, to grow the economy. There's been many, many changes. You can see that in the streets with the restaurants, the increase in hotels. Tourism is on the rise still, despite the Trump's attempt to ban people from going there. So, in fact, Díaz-Canel has been first vice president up until today. He's been first vice president of the Council of State and of the ministries. So he's been part of the several years of these new economic changes, and he's part of this whole leadership discussion along with the National Assembly on how to manage the economy and make the necessary changes. But they are evaluating some of the problems that have resulted. some of the corruption that has arisen, some of the theft, some of these restaurants that have been amassing, you know, a lot of money. And so the government had suspended the licensing, the granting of licensing, to evaluate what has taken place and how can we arrest some of these problems.
All right. Arnold August, go ahead.
Yeah, I think just building on what you just said, I think I just spoke to a couple of my colleagues in Havana this afternoon, and I asked them what they thought about Miguel Díaz-Canel's acceptance speech. And the person or the people, they all pretty much said the same thing, was extraordinary. It was really something special. I said, why? Because he put a lot of emphasis on the need for the Cuban Revolution to be self-critical, to look at the problems and try to overcome some of the problems, such as Gloria just mentioned, some of the problems that exist as a result of the economic reforms, to be self-critical and make the necessary changes. And I think the other point that was mentioned in discussion with my Cuban colleagues today, in both Díaz-Canel's speech as well as Raúl's speech, both of them mention the need to reform the Constitution. That is, in the coming years, there is definitely going to be discussion on the Constitution, and invariably, when you have discussion on the Constitution, we're talking about a referendum. And when you talk about a referendum in Cuba, it means discussion at the grassroots level over a long period of time, over many months, whereby people could give their opinions on how to deal with different problems, such as, for example, that you have inequality that is sort of built into the new reforms. In fact, I believe, according to what my friend said today, that Raúl mentioned he complained about people becoming almost millionaires in Cuba because of taking advantage of these loopholes in order to build up their own personal well-being. So I think Cuba is going through a stage now where they're going to confront head on some of the problems. And I think that the next few years, the reform of the Constitution is going to be a very important point. And going back to what you said in previous experiences, for example, in the Soviet Union and other countries such as China, Cuba is really strong on unity. It was also announced today. I was a bit surprised. I didn't expect that, but it was announced today. Not only was Díaz-Canel elected to be president of Cuba, but it was also announced today at the next Congress, Party Congress, in 2021, in about 3 years, he is going to be proposed to be first secretary of the Communist Party of Cuba. Why is that? The Cubans put a lot of emphasis on unity, and it's only normal from their point of view, irrespective of what we may think, of their point of view, that the same person who was the head of the party is also the head of the state. So they're carrying on that tradition of unity.
Arnold, what's the essence, or what do you think the essence is, of the constitutional reforms? What are we talking about?
Well, I think one of the main features has to be the question of improving the political system. One has to take into account during the last elections in March 11th of just a couple of months ago, when the national elections took place for the deputies who are now sitting in parliament, the voter turnout went down 5%. That was in addition to a 5% drop in the previous elections in 2013. So in the Cuban terms, this is it's a major a change. Of course, if we look at it from the terms of the United States, it's very high, 85%. But if you look at it from the Cuban context, 85% turnout is very low. That is, 1.4 million Cubans did not turn out to vote. Now, what is of interest, and this is shows also the changes that are going on in Cuba. I don't know if you're aware of this, Brian, but a few months ago, there was a new director named to Granma, which is a newspaper, official newspaper of the Communist Party of Cuba, a 35-year-old young activist woman. For the first time in the history of Cuba, she's very active on Facebook, the social media. She has close ties with the base. She was named to that post, and not too long after that, about a month ago, she dared to have an online exchange between the readers of Granma and the people responsible for the elections in Cuba. And I didn't have time to look at all the comments. There were literally hundreds of comments online. But it would be safe to say one of the main features of the comments or the questions that people had is that there has to be more input from the people as to who should be nominated, eventually elected to be president of Cuba. In fact, when I was in Cuba just a few weeks ago, I spoke to some of my Cuban colleagues. When I speak about Cuban colleagues, of course, they're all members of the Communist Party or very close. I do not speak to dissidents. So just you have a clear picture. And they all pretty much the same thing, said the same thing. There has to be improvement in terms of having more input from the grassroots as to who should be the president of Cuba. And other similar changes have to take place in the political system. And also with regards to what Gloria mentioned, there's a large number of 600,000 self-employed, and the current constitution does not really take into account that section of society, which is not really socialist as such. So there's a lot of important points that will be facing the people in terms of the reform of the constitution. I would say in the next few years, it's going to be very exciting to watch the discussion and debate in Cuba.
Gloria, go ahead.
Yes, well, I think that it's important to understand that the process of consultation has been very deep in Cuba in particular moments. In 1993, the newly elected National Assembly actually suspended its session until over 80,000 workplace meetings were held, and of the mass organizations, the whole population took part in hearing the proposals on the new economic changes that were coming, and that there was consultation with the more than 8 million people. And from that, I think you could see through the whole period of the 90s and the 2000s of the severe economic crisis for Cuba, that the people having a part, understanding, informed on a complete basis what was taking place and what was needed, the closing of factories, the self-employment, the laying off people, well, of course, they still got unemployment benefits, that it was a people who were informed and agreeing to those changes and the sacrifice needed. It happened again just a few years ago of a consultation across the board before the party Congress that took place. So it's not like it hasn't taken place. I think that it's a little bit speculative to know what is going to take place with the Constitution. I wouldn't venture to say what it will be. I think there's a lot of discussion now about the lower turnout in the elections. A lot of people have told me in Cuba it's because there's so many people who are self-employed, working on Sunday, for example, when the elections are. There could be also other reasons for it, but there will be a nationwide social research investigation to understand and to have the input of people. I want to emphasize, though, that so much of this self-employment is on a very, very minimal level. You have, you know, bicycle taxi workers, people who perhaps have a better income, but it's a substitution for having been employed by the state. And the great, great need of the country is to be able to truly develop economically on a much higher basis, technologically. And what's needed is for this blockade to end. It still exists. It's very much in place. And that's the crying need of the Cuban people and for us to be aware of that.
That's where I want to go, because clearly relations have soured, Arnold. I mean, they have soured a lot under President Trump. President Obama did something historic. First time in 54 years, embassies were opened, the U.S. embassy in Havana. The Cubans opened the U.S. A Cuban embassy here in Washington, D.C., not too far from where we are. There was the beginning of different kinds of interaction. The blockade was still in place, a very vigorous, robust blockade, which imposed financial penalties on foreign banks that extended credit to Cuba. So even under Obama, it was very difficult for Cuba to do trade at the international level. Trade is more expensive. It's hard to get credit. And of course, Cuba's natural trading partner would be the United States. It's 90 miles away. It certainly was the case before the revolution in 1959. Now, Donald Trump is, you know, not closed the embassy, but he's basically drained the embassy of personnel, clearly imposing new hardships on Cuba. Could not really be any anticipation of relief on the international scale for sanctions or the embargo or the blockade. The Cubans rightfully call it the blockade of Cuba. And at the same time, as Cuba has tried to increase petty capitalist ownership. So because the state can't sustain and support the entire population as it once could, there's a lot of frustration, undoubtedly, because for capital to build up, even in the private sector, it requires international liaison, international connections. And yet international connection to capital is very hard to come by because of the blockade.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's an important point that both of you who have been raising regarding the blockade. At the same time, Cuba has a lot of experience going back to 1959. And since Trump came to power a short while ago, I've noticed that Cuba has increased its economic and diplomatic relations with such countries such as China. For example, the main trade partner of Cuba at this time is China. The same thing is with regards to Russia, where they are collaborating with Russia to develop the struggling oil industry in Cuba, as well as with other countries such as Iran. And Europe is also quite an important factor. Only a few months ago, the leader of the European Union, which I think we all agree, the European Union is not a minor factor in international economic, in the international political and economic field, came to Cuba and made it a point to oppose and denounce Trump's activity with regards to the blockade against Cuba, and stressing that the European Union will once again establish further economic and trade relations with Cuba. So Cuba is not standing idly by. They know that the blockade is going to be there for quite some time, if not forever, but they are building their own relations with other countries.
All right. We have less than 2 minutes left. Gloria, the point that Arnold was making, that people in Cuba may want to have a greater political impact, sort of input, Cuba's got a problem, which is they can't have, or they believe they can't have, and I think this is correct, multiple political parties vying for power, because the United States, which is this awesomely powerful empire 90 miles to the north that's done everything to smash the revolution, will create its own party in Cuba. It will easily be able to do that. It will fund it. It will become the most well-funded agency in Cuba. So Cuba has a limitation on its democracy because of those relationship of forces. And yet there is an aspiration on the part of the Cuban people to have greater input. How does that take place? And Gloria, before you answer that question, I want to stipulate and let the audience know that there's a lot of confusion about the role of the Communist Party in Cuba's electoral processes. It's a complicated question. It's a nuanced question. It's widely misunderstood. It's misrepresented in the Western and especially the U.S. press. We want to talk about that. We'll have to do that in another segment. But first, let's just get your reaction.
I do think that there's a lot of debate. There are a lot of people who want to be able to have more freedom to make more money. They're the ones who are richer. There are many, many people, the workers, and those who have the self-employment that's very minor, who are unhappy about the inequality that's developing among people who are visibly, you know, bragging about it.
All right, we're completely out of time. We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined in studio by Arnold August. He's a lecturer, journalist, and the author of the book Cuba and the U.S. in the Age of Trump. And we're joined from San Francisco by Gloria LaRiva. She is the director of the Cuba and Venezuela Solidarity Committee. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for John Kiriakou today.
Today we continue our weekly series, it's every Thursday, called Criminal Injustice with Kevin Gastala and Paul Wright, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com. and the co-host of the podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright. He is the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News. Kevin and Paul, welcome back.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for having us on the show.
Paul, we spoke to you earlier this week about the prison, I don't know what you call it, fighting, rioting in Lee prison facility in South Carolina. It was terrible. The images that Prison Legal News provided to Sputnik, we actually, the editors decided not to use them because they were so graphic, but SputnikNews.com did do a major article on it. Let's just do an update from both of you about what's going on at this facility. Go ahead, Paul.
Basically, it seems that, you know, the facility is locked down and, you know, prison officials are trying to, I think, deflect responsibility on their part for what happened. The bulk of the information that we're getting at this point is basically from prisoners communicating on their own cell phones about, you know, the only dispute that we're getting from the official narrative from the government is what prisoners are able to send out on their cell phones type thing. So that, in some respects, that's been good. And interestingly enough, the DOC, they're claiming that the problems are all because prisoners have cell phones. But one of the news outlets, The Root, had some pretty interesting stuff citing prison guards who wanted to remain anonymous, talking about both the prevalence of cell phones within the prison and also noting that it sounds like basically the prison is very much out of control and that the guards themselves basically don't do much, if anything, to secure the prison or interfere with gangs that are in the prison or anything like that. So basically what's coming out is very much a picture of a prison system that is, you know, very poorly managed and not doing a very good job of, you know, some of its fundamental core functions of, you know, maintaining a safe environment for the prisoners that are being held in it.
And I think, you know, according to Prison Legal News, who y'all were able to speak with somebody in the prison, and I've seen a couple of inmates and friends of inmates post on Facebook and on other social media, there's definitely some theories going on that this may have been intentional. If it wasn't intentional, it was very, very sloppy with people being transferred who had already been in some sort of gang fight in other institutions, transferring them from opposing gangs into the same housing unit, which, I mean, is very clearly not a good idea. And for people who have been running prisons is obviously a problem and not something that they should be doing. On Prison Legal News, the source said this has been an ongoing beef from an incident that happened at Lieber Correctional. Bloods and folks have been fighting for over a year. What SCDC, which is the South Carolina Department of Corrections, what SCDC does is when a gang fight happens, they move inmates to other institutions, they meet up with other members, and they put those guys in the same dorms with the gang that the person that just got into it with. It just doesn't, you know, this is not a good idea and is potentially even something they're doing on purpose to try to get rid of cell phones, which are, as we can see, able to get real photos and real information out to the public, which is not something that prisons normally have, you know, to hold accountable. Kevin, what have you been seeing?
Well, I just would say that in this situation, it tends to be that what you hear is a focus on staff shortages or there's something about the guards. But also, you know, you have a tinderbox kind of a situation when you have abysmal conditions inside these facilities. And so it's quite easy for something to be set off like this. And so in this case, as you're talking about specifically gangs being mixed, that tends to be something that especially when the authorities are responsible, they don't want to lend credence. I mean, I can even speak from experience when they shut down schools in cities and they move people from underserved neighborhoods or low-income neighborhoods, they mix gangs, Latino or Black, whatever they might be, they don't want to take responsibility for that violence. The same thing happens in the case of prisons, them not wanting to take responsibility. And again, also in coverage, you have a focus on these so-called contraband cell phones that people are using. And I think it's important to mention that somebody's going to be getting rich off of this latest violence. And the company is Tekor Networks that has a contract with the South Carolina Department of Corrections. And they're looking, in fact, to increase their ability to make it impossible for inmates to get calls out with these unauthorized cell phones.
And it's worth noting, too, Kevin, that that company is owned by Securus, I believe, which has the monopoly to charge prisoners exorbitant rates for their phone calls out of the prison. So on the one hand, they market, they have the monopoly contract for the phone calls, and on the other hand, they also own the company that does the cell phone blocking, which then drives all phone calls through their system.
We're talking with Kevin Gostala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com and also Paul Wright. Paul is the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazine. Let's just explore the issue again for people who don't know about prison culture and prison life. And of course, many people unfortunately do know about it because this is the center of mass incarceration in the world. By the way, James Comey, according to an article in The Intercept, says that he criticized Barack Obama for using the words mass incarceration. He thought it undermined law enforcement. Anyway, we can talk about that too. But yes, our beloved guardian of democracy.
James Comey.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, how does gang culture exist in the prisons? Is it supported, promoted by prison guards, by prison administrations? Just explain a little, both of you, how it works.
Basically, I view prison gangs as basically it's literally the administration's first line of defense. One of the reasons prison administrators, I think, are able to rule prisons to the extent they do is by maintaining the prison population divided and conquered, especially along race and ethnic lines. And, you know, they play the race card like a fine-tuned violin. And they ensure that prisoners are they're not even monolithic by race, but also they break up. You know, black prisoners are broken up into different factions. Latino and Hispanic prisoners are as well. And, you know, and basically it just serves to ensure that there's a fractured prison population and that they're able to do more of what they want without it. The other thing is that, you know, one of my observations about organized crime is that organized crime cannot exist without the support of the government, and that's in prison as well as outside of prison. And, you know, typically all the stories about prison gangs, you know, there's always collusion between the administrators and the guards in ensuring that the gangs are able to carry out their criminal activities. And it's often at behest of, you know, it's often at the behest of prison administrators. And this is just an ongoing pattern that we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years.
Kevin, did you have thoughts on that too?
Well, just what I would add, you know, when I think about this issue, I think it's most vividly captured by what has and probably continues in the Pelican Bay prison in California, where you have a system of what they call gang validation that the prison had really leaned on to use. And it would result in people being put in solitary confinement because they were found to be part of gangs. You set up an informant system. You set up a culture where people are snitching on each other, and there's rewards for saying things about an individual. And it doesn't matter if they're true or false, if it's actionable information that they can use. Similar to the way it has actually functioned in the war on terrorism, people are being put in solitary confinement and were put in harsh conditions, and it was really impossible for them to get out. And, you know, to some extent, that continues.
Absolutely. I also wanted to talk today. So today is the date where Walter Leroy Moody is scheduled to be executed. Moody is in Alabama. He's on death row for a 1989 killing of a judge. He has maintained his innocence this entire time, which, you know, we know from many examples of many people and from studies that people who maintain their innocence for that entire length of time, I mean, there's no point after a while, right? You're in prison. But people who maintain their innocence for that long often are actually innocent. But regardless, he is on death row and he is 83 years old. 83 years old. He's the oldest man.
Well, once he's executed, Nicole, the country will be a lot safer.
A lot safer from this 83-year-old. Yeah, for sure. I'm sure he is extremely able to kill and wants to, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I just couldn't. Obviously, I can believe this sort of thing happens all the time, but this is scheduled for today. So I thought we should talk about Mr. Moody. Kevin, do you have any thoughts on this situation?
Well, I remember we've talked about how there's no, you know, compassionate release, or there's this move away from releasing people who are elderly. It's been quite a trend for a long time. I don't know. I can't speak a lot to the specifics in this case, but I know that just from our prior conversations on the show that, you know, someone who is 83 years old obviously should be able to, you know, at the very worst, be just on like home confinement in their home. I mean, I can't imagine Moody's going to be alive for much longer. He's 83 years old. But it's about punishment. It's about as much as the Justice Department can get out of a person. And it's with no consideration for the lives of people.
Right. And the torture of sitting on death row for what is that? I was born in 1988 and I'm turning 30. So this must be 29 years of sitting on death row my entire life. You know, that's not that isn't enough torture, not enough punishment right there.
I want to go back to James Comey's book because I don't know, higher loyalty. I want to read a little bit of it. Gosh, I mean, Comey describes a session where he speaks about the FBI in a talk to Chicago in 2015. Comey describes the session in his book. This is from The Intercept. And he seemed to double down, telling the country's first black president that the law enforcement community was upset at the way Obama had used the phrase mass incarceration. It was offensive, Comey told the president. Quote, I thought the term was both inaccurate and insulting to a lot of good people in law enforcement who care deeply about helping people trapped in dangerous neighborhoods. It was inaccurate in the sense that there was nothing, quote, mass, unquote, about the incarceration. Every defendant was charged individually, representing individually by counsel, convicted by a court individually, sentenced individually, reviewed on appeal individually, and incarcerated. That added up to a lot of people in jail, but there was nothing mass about it. That's James Comey, now the beloved icon for liberalism, Paul Wright.
Well, and I think that's the classic, I think that's the classic response you want to expect from a police state bureaucrat. And, you know, and it's interesting that they don't take pride in their handiwork is that, you know, you run a police state and the biggest evidence of it is, well, 2.5 million people locked up. And by comparison, both in raw numbers and terms of the population, the U.S. has more people incarcerated today and even more if we count probation and parole than either Nazi Germany or Stalin's Russia at the height of the purges ever had incarcerated under official state control in those countries. So, you know, so to say that and also, I find it's kind of interesting, too, this whole notion that he talks about individual judicial determinations when it's kind of like, obviously, Mr. Comey has never been in the courtrooms of this country where they have cattle call arraignments where 200 individuals are arraigned in an hour or 2 hours. We've really perfected the conveyor belt system of nominal justice. And, I mean, literally, people are processed into our prisons. And there's very little that's individualized about them. So for him to say stuff like that, I think just bespeaks a total ignorance of the reality of the government process that at one point he oversaw and, helped facilitate. So, but that type of defensiveness, I think, is just kind of interesting because it's the issue of just trying to deny reality. And the other thing, too, is I'm not really sure why he's grumpy with Obama, because at the end of the day, Obama did pretty much nothing in terms of affecting the actual numbers of people incarcerated. Yes, he reduced some sentences, which were already obscenely long, but he still left them pretty obscenely long. I mean, reducing someone's sentence from 40 years to 30 years for a drug conspiracy charge that didn't even involve any drugs, for example.
Not exactly justice.
Not exactly justice, but it's kind of like, relative. I think that, taking a ridiculously long sentence and still keeping it kind of ridiculously long, just not as long. But at the end of the day, Obama's, he didn't do anything that actually reduced the number of people in prison in any measurable way. So, so that's some of the things that I think are, I'm just kind of puzzled that, I'm just very puzzled that, that Comey would even bother wasting his ire on Obama over something like that.
Yeah, Kevin, I want you to respond too. I mean, it shows that the law, so-called law enforcement community, there is no community, the law enforcement hierarchy, the cops, if anybody suggests anything is amiss in the U.S. criminal justice system, if anyone suggests that mass incarceration is a phenomena rather than just, coincidentally one out of four prisoners in the world are in U.S. prisons, and that's a consequence only of their own wrongdoing. If anyone attributes it to the system itself, then they've sort of smeared every law enforcement officer. They've smeared the wonderful system of justice, meaning if you criticize, then you become like their target. I mean, it's really sort of a, when you're the FBI director and you have all that power and that weight, when you're the 700-pound gorilla and you can sit wherever you want, and you criticize the sitting president of the United States because he wants to reform the system of mass incarceration, I mean, it's also kind of a message to all other politicians. Don't bother trying to criticize, even in the mildest way, even by somebody like Obama, who, as Paul mentioned, helped, you know, well, didn't help contribute to the system of mass incarceration, but didn't help to really undo it either.
Yeah. These are the same people, Comey included, who are responsible for things like the so-called ACLU effect. Like when they challenge police accountability, they're actually making it easier for criminals to attack law enforcement or get away with crimes. There's just no evidence to support that. He's the same kind of person who promotes the idea that there's something called a Ferguson effect, like the uprising in Ferguson contributed to a lack of ability of law enforcement or police to protect themselves or do their jobs. It's just complete crap. It's not true. And what's dangerous here, I think, is that someone like Comey goes out there, he paints himself as this moderate conservative who's criticizing President Barack Obama and the way in which he carried out his policies as far as criminal justice reform goes. And as Paul described in detail, it didn't really go that far. It didn't really accomplish much. And yet, by criticizing that, you're really defining what our system is going to tolerate in terms of reform. You're really narrowing it. You're really putting a limit on what law enforcement is going to allow before they push back and flagrantly do whatever they can to make sure that they don't have to follow laws, that there is no justice. And I would just add finally that assembly lines have people individually lined up and they make mass quantities of products. Nobody would deny that they're not making massive quantities and that in the process, they themselves are going through jobs that are usually starvation wages or that they're being mistreated and they're in sweatshop conditions. But nobody would deny that there is something en masse going on, even though it is a bunch of individuals making individual things. He's basically doing what we call concern trolling and picking apart something without actually going at the policy of addressing mass incarceration, because he knows if he engages the topic like we do on these shows week to week, he's going to lose.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And to your prior point about James Comey painting himself as this moderate conservative, it's even further than that right now. He's mostly in the news, at least mostly painting himself as anti-Trump, which is, of course, making all the liberals out there are extremely happy.
And good for sales.
And exactly, that's exactly right. Good for book sales. Brian, I mean, we've seen this week after week with James Comey painting himself as this, you know, friend of liberals.
Kevin Gastella from Shadowproof and Paul Wright from Prison Legal News are our guests, as they are every Thursday on this segment called Criminal Injustice. And you can hear our show every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM. You can follow us at Loud Clear Radio or on Facebook with at our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. Paul Wright, again, I want to quote to you from the Comey book, and this is him justifying why Martha Stewart had to go to jail in 2003, which is kind of because she lied about an insider stock tip. Quote, people must, I mean, this shows the righteousness of Comey. People must fear the consequences of lying in the justice system, or the system can't work. There was once a time when most people worried about going to hell if they violated an oath taken in the name of God. That divine deterrence has slipped away from our modern cultures. In its place, people must fear going to jail. They must fear their lives being turned upside down. They must fear their pictures splashed on newspapers and websites. People must fear having their names forever associated with a criminal act, if we are to have a nation with the rule of law. I mean, the self-righteousness of this individual is amazing on his white horse, But again, when you think about whose name is being associated with a criminal act, whose names are on the front page of newspapers, no criminal referrals for the Wall Street meltdown, unlike the 1989 savings and loan crisis meltdown there, where there were 30,000 criminal referrals and 1,000 criminal convictions. There was absolutely zero this time around. So here you have the same FBI on its white horse, and this guy talking like this. He's sad that people no longer fear the wrath of God when they lie and don't follow the oath they've taken. Anyway, go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was going to say, with the prevalence of testifying and lying by law enforcement under oath in criminal proceedings, including the FBI and congressional proceedings, or, you know, we have the NSA, the general in charge of the NSA, denying there's any illegal surveillance of Americans going on, which Edward Snowden clearly showed he was lying and committing perjury. All these people are lying with impunity. And everyone's down with it, or I should say everyone in a position of power is down with it. You know, we're not seeing, these intelligence agents, we're not seeing these police officers, whether it's lying about the mass surveillance of Americans to Congress or lying about the individual drug bust in the county court in San Diego or Miami or whatever. All these people are lying every day with impunity. And the big thing is that everyone knows they're lying. You know, in the criminal context, the judges, the prosecutors, and the defense attorneys and the defendants know they're lying. In the case of Congress, everyone in Congress knows they're lying. So, you know, I think this is a case where, you know, it would carry a lot more, you know, might carry a lot more weight if what he was saying is that there's actually some examples of, you know, FBI agents being prosecuted for perjury or NSA generals being prosecuted for lying to Congress. And, you know, even if we actually had the cases of the police officers that are routinely lying in court in cases, if they were being held to account, and likewise their lawyers. But that's not happening. I mean, in some respects, I think that Comey's actually got a point there, where he says, yeah, they don't fear the consequences of lying. But I would say that the reason they don't is because it's been so institutionalized by our government actors that everyone sees them lying with impunity. And I think it demeans our entire system of justice.
Yeah, absolutely. In other news, I wanted to follow up on a piece that I think we have talked about on this segment before. There's some new news going on. There was a county sheriff-run jail, where jail guards intentionally or not dehydrated a young man who was in the midst of a mental health crisis. He had flooded his cell twice a week. And so for a little bit, he was, again, in the middle of a mental health crisis. And so they went ahead and just shut off the water to his sink and his toilet. And then that means that he did not actually get any water for a very long time until he died. He was 25 years old. So, you know, in the midst of this really atrocious crime, the two guards pleaded guilty, and they were charged with and pleaded guilty to false reporting by a public officer, which is a misdemeanor. I'm not sure how that got pled down from what I hope was a charge of murder. I doubt that it was. But they were sentenced this week to a year in jail with all but 3 months suspended. And I guess due to some of the jail time calculations, only 5 days for each of them must be served behind bars. I mean, this, as in so many cases in the criminal justice system, really shows the disparity between people who are a part of it and get kind of near impunity, and people who are not a part of it and get sentenced. Just like we were talking about, Paul, for, you know, 30 or 40 years for a drug charge where there were no drugs actually involved. Kevin, do you want to address this kind of really gross disparity here? We've got about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, I would say for Keaton Ferris and his family and any friends, what happens in this situation, to me, this is how I view it, is you really see how you just can't really get any kind of justice, the sort of justice you would want. And so you start to bargain with yourself and accept a lower form of justice. And in this case, I imagine anyone looking at what happened and the horrible outcome here, part of you says, at least I suppose it's good that the system has convicted these people for something. It's better than nothing.
But it so rarely happens at all.
Yeah. And you have situations where in this case, these guards you have situations where they wouldn't be charged with crimes, and then you'd spend a lot of time fighting to get them fired from the prisons. Or if they're officers, you spend a lot of time fighting to get the departments to fire these officers. So I think that's the big takeaway here, is that at least they get something, because in so many cases, there's just nothing for these people.
And I mean, what we would want, right? Wouldn't it be great if actually these guards didn't have to serve time in prison because they never killed him in the first place? Wouldn't it be great if this guy wasn't in prison for a mental health crisis, who was 25 years old? I mean, that would be the kind of justice that you and I would want in the first place. And even here, we're not getting that for sure. But even that, you know, we're not getting any justice from this whatsoever.
Yeah. And sadly, of course, as long as there's impunity, as long as people are not going to prison or are able to keep killing without real consequences, the system goes on and on and on. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com and the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we've been joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.